Hello, I'm Adam Williams, and welcome to the latest in our DMH Stoward Employment Law podcast series. Company insolvency levels during the second half of 2023 were about 2,200 per month, which is 53% higher than the same period in 2022, and after a long period of historically low levels of insolvency proceedings. And in fact, company insolvencies in Q2 and Q3 2023 were at their highest level since Q2 2009. And it doesn't look like there's any sign of a decline in the levels in 2024. And it's clear that the combined impacts of Brexit, COVID-19, high inflation, and cost of living pressures have created what we might call a perfect storm for insolvency events. And on the 16th of January 2024, it was reported in The Independent that company insolvencies are on track for a 14-year annual high. Taking all that into consideration, and also the public relations PR factor of this, with high profile insolvencies hitting the headlines across a number of sectors. And since 2022, if we take just a few examples, you've had Cath Kidston, Paper Chase, WeWork, Wilko, Jules, Hunters, Together Energy, three Premiership rugby clubs, TM Lewin, Made.com, many others. I mean, the list goes on. There are thousands of smaller companies as well, though, that fail, and the impact on their employees will be commercially and personally devastating. So, that's our subject for today. What do we mean by an insolvency event, even? Are we clear on what that means, as employers or those dealing with employment issues? What are the key elements of the associated processes with these insolvency events? And what support is there for businesses out there and employees who find themselves or themselves in difficulties? And why is it important to take advice early in certain scenarios? And then, of course, follow that advice. So, with me to help answer those questions, and probably we will end up talking about some others, I'd like to welcome Michael Lynch. Michael's a partner in the restructuring insolvency team based in London. He's been acting for nearly 15 years, I think 9 or 15 years, in the insolvency arena for parties subject to complex and high-value disputes within the insolvency context. And that often has a cross-border element as well. He's acted for corporate shareholders, insolvency practitioners, lenders, and individuals across a broad range of restructuring and insolvency situations. So, comes to us with a wealth of knowledge and experience on this area. And then a previous speaker on our podcast series, listeners will be familiar with, Rebecca Thornley Gibson, a partner in the employment team with over 30 years' experience dealing with the good, the bad, and as she puts it, the downright ugly of employee relations. And Rebecca has significant experience working with employers dealing with complex and contentious restructuring and redundancy situations, so is well placed to provide our employment law and context to this discussion as well. So this is great. I'm going to be learning a lot today, guys, I'm sure. Can we kick off with you, Michael? We hear about companies who've gone into administration, or have been, sometimes we hear they've been liquidated, or we hear that they've had insolvency practitioners appointed, or then, press or colloquially down the pub that, oh, they've gone bust, if you're using more colloquial languages. What can you just simplify that, if possible? What a company insolvency means?
Yeah, I hope I can simplify. I think what bust means in sort of colloquial terms, a sort of Americanism that's come over the pond, is essentially that a company no longer trades, it's closed its doors, and no longer is in business. But if we step back, I think really what when people talk about insolvency, the legal position, and I don't want to sort of go straight into a legal definition, but really it's quite a simple definition actually, as they go, is that it's considered when a company cannot pay its debts as and when they fall due. That's known as a cash flow test, or when its liabilities, including contingent liabilities, exceed its assets, and that's known as a balance sheet test. That again is sort of pure legal summary, but if you're in a position running a company as a director, and you cannot pay your debts as they fall due, or you're thinking you cannot pay, or you realize that sort of your asset position or your liability position is exceeds your asset position, then you might be deemed insolvent. And then you sort of jump into kind of what do you mean by administration? What do you mean by liquidation? Administration is a formal insolvency where the company has entered into administration. I'll come back to that. And liquidation, again, is another type of formal insolvency where a company enters into liquidation. Now, there are three types of liquidation, two of which are insolvent liquidations. One's compulsory, which is winding up by the court. And then another is called creditors voluntary liquidation, where the company decides to enter into liquidation. The third, very quickly, is known as members voluntary. That's a solvent liquidation where the business decides to wind up and then distribute to shareholders.
So it's a complex and multifaceted area. We've got different routes down which we know insolvency is exquisitely simple in its definition of those two tests, but that it can then manifest in a range of different outcomes, not all of which, it seems clear from what you're saying, are fatal, if I can use that expression. We've got that concept of rescue culture, haven't we? But clearly, nonetheless, very distressing, whether you're the business owner or the person with a job and wondering what the position is going to be next month. If a company's worried about its financial position, I imagine it can be quite a lonely place when you're sitting around the boardroom, or indeed you're the only one sitting in the room thinking, what do we do next? What options do they have if you're the owner slash manager?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lonely place, whether you're running a small family business or you're running a multi-jurisdictional PLC. The responsibility and the buck stops with the board and the directors, if you like. It's always quite sort of trite or unhelpful for, someone like me to be telling others some advice, especially those who are running businesses that were successful and that have sort of come across difficulties. But sort of from my experience of being in this R&I arena, I think there are three takeaways. First is, as soon as directors are aware that their company is in financial difficulty or may be in financial difficulty for whatever reason, they should seek external independent advice from an insolvency practitioner if possible. They should also keep retaining, or if they haven't, start retaining management information and financial information, clear financial information going forward for their lenders, or to give over to insolvency practitioners so they can really assess the business, for example, in an independent business review, which a bank may require. And the third is to be proactive rather than reactive with lenders and creditors. Most lenders, major clearing banks, will have teams of experienced restructuring staff who can genuinely help as long as they get there early enough. And that sort of leads me to the sort of underlying point, which is the earlier you deal with the issues, the better.
Yeah. And how different is this? This is a question I've just come to my mind now. How different is this, if at all, to managing one's household finances? What are the telltale signs? Is it that each month we seem to be getting into a worse and worse financial position? So we're not necessarily met one of those two tests yet, but is it that you look and go, the financial position is worsening and I can't see where it's going to turn the corner and get better? Is that a good place to start and go? So yeah. I need to anticipate where that might end.
Yeah,
and take advice.
It's a useful analogy, the sort of household expenses, but I think with businesses, it's a bit more multifaceted and complex, and sometimes more nuanced. You might be running a great business and suddenly one of your major contracts drops and you're left with lack of money's coming in and you have to scramble to get more work in. And there's a period of time where perhaps you're not, the cash flow is tight it's not there. And so you look to seek how to fill that gap with a lender. Yeah. So it's really quite difficult, and the landscape of a business will change over time, market forces and so on. So I think it's, that's a useful analogy, but each business faces its own difficult hurdles and financial difficulties.
Yeah, yeah, and it can manifest in different ways rather than just in a sort of completely simplistic way that I described. Rebecca, coming to you and taking that example that Michael just gave there about, business directors are considering a whole range of issues as part of a ending insolvency. Let's say they've lost their, they've got into a position where nearly half their business is with one client. That contract's just suddenly gone pop. They know it's going to have a huge financial impact and will be, there'll be distress in the business. What should they be doing in respect of employees? Is it okay to dismiss them, just make them redundant straight away? Don't pay them because someone else will pick up the tab? What should they be thinking about?
Yes, well, before I answer any of those, I think we ought to apologise to our listeners for a very depressing podcast. I think this might be the most depressing podcast we've done in the last 12 months. And I think we have to promise something a little bit more upbeat next time. But
you're quite right. But let's try and put some positives at the end of it. We'll try and find some chinks of light. Michael's going to deliver that at the end of the session, I'm sure, of the hope.
I hope so. And I think there's, you know, there is hope if you actually don't do something which a lot of companies probably do in these scenarios, which is probably go into panic mode. I mean, a lot of, you know, a lot of companies will have taken a whole range of measures along the sort of the cost cutting sort of side before they even think about going to an insolvency practitioner, before they think about independent business reviews. So they might have looked at salary reductions, they might have looked at traditional redundancies, they might have looked at cutting employee hours. But there then gets to a point where I think, you know, somebody has to, you know, take some really quite, you know, decisive action if they are looking at an insolvency event. But as part of that decisive action, it should not mean that they say, right, okay, well, we're going to just dismiss a whole load of employees here because we're not going to be around in a few months to pick up the mess from this, or the company's not going to have to pick up the liabilities arising from dismissals that that we've just undertaken. I think the key thing is to recognise employees have employment rights irrespective of the financial state of the company. So, you know, the directors absolutely have to ensure that they consider those rights. And if they don't know what they are, how to observe those rights and take expert advice as to what they should be doing with their employees.
Yeah. Sorry, Rebecca, I was going to say that feeds back into your point, Michael, about taking advice. And when you're taking that advice, it should dovetail in with issues around what do we do with the employees, because employees' rights will subsist throughout the process. It's just the nature of those rights depends on the context, and therefore the timing is key. As Rebecca's saying, you know, we shouldn't make knee-jerk reactions to try and avoid liabilities. And indeed, directors can have personal liabilities if they get it wrong, Michael. I mean, that's something you must have seen and been in your career seeking to avoid, if you're acting for directors, seeking to avoid them stepping on landmines.
Yeah, absolutely. And unsurprising, there's a whole raft of legislation that and case law that protects sort of creditors and third parties from, you know, persons using companies for their own personal ends. Sort of parking aside the you know, fraudsters and the nefarious, if one is running a business as best one can, not trying to be too negative as well, it's not too difficult to become tied up personally in relation to a company's problems. And I think to mitigate that risk, directors should be first and foremost aware of their duties, directors' duties and potential liabilities if their company's facing financial difficulties. So I think it's important sort of in the round to review when facing such difficulties. There are overlapping issues that include, you know, what steps can the business take to keep afloat without committing an offence or incurring personal liability? When can they end trading and how? If an end is inevitable, and it doesn't need to be, you know, there are lots of processes that allow rescues of companies. But if an end is inevitable, what kind of end is required? I.e. what formal insolvency procedure? And so tied into all of that is what advice should be sought and for whom? So the company and or the directors in their personal capacity. sort of all this plays into what I think should be the thing in the sort of forefront of a director's mind, amongst other stuff, personal stuff as well, when they are looking at their business going forward. So I don't know if you want me to go into the claims and so on. I mean, I'm happy to go into that. But
well, yeah, let me run a scenario past you, and maybe you can tell us in a benign or a malignant scenario what that might give rise to in claims. And then we'll come on to how IP, our insolvency practitioners and administrators, will have liabilities here as well, won't they, when they take on an instruction. But if you take a business and obviously it's become distressed, they have a key client perhaps, or creditor, I should say, who comes to the directors and says, has got a sense of this and says, you know, you need to make sure, I'm one of your biggest revenue generators, you need to make sure you pay this or do that. How much of a red flag is that when you're a director and you're looking at the situation and it looks like there might be very good business reasons why you need to prioritize what money you have left to paying a certain party, because that's the lifeblood of the organization in your view, but that presumably has varying degrees of risk?
Yeah, it does. And obviously it's all sort of fact sensitive and fact dependent on in terms of when payments are made and so on. I think it's probably better to take a step back and say sort of the various claims that can be brought or that arise from companies and the directors not taking proper steps or taking steps that they shouldn't within the context of the insolvency regime. Such most, you know, a lot of claims can be brought by administrators or liquidators of companies. For example, if you're trading when you're insolvent, that's wrongful trading, or you're doing, you know, more naughtier, taking naughtier steps where you end up in sort of fraudulent trading, or by disgruntled creditors. So disgruntled creditors can take action if they want to, such as a claim known as transaction defrauding creditors, or even they can bring a misfeasance claim, which is a breach of director's duties in the context of a director making payments to one creditor, for example, over another. Yeah. And further particular claims under the Insolvency Act you know, have been developed to protect creditors, such as where there are breaches of director's duties, I've mentioned misfeasance, or where there is fraud. For example, if you're materially omitting information in your accounts and so on and so forth, or where there are questionable transactions leading to an insolvency. So I think ultimately it's worth flagging in the context of this discussion that there's recent case law which has also given rise to an active duty on company directors to take account of creditor interest. So without getting into too much detail, back in 2022, the Supreme Court confirmed what's known as a common law duty of directors to take into account and give appropriate weight to the interest of company's creditors in certain circumstances. And that's known as a creditor duty now in this world.
So in simple terms, that's the director's board sitting around the table and going, well, we could do that. And it looks like on the face of it, that could be helpful for the business. But our landlord, who we owe X amount of money to, is going to impact them in a disproportionate way. They probably won't see any money.
Yeah.
I just give a simple example.
I guess sort of it's in practical terms, that duty arises where either the company is insolvent and we have to go back to taking advice on that as a board, or where the company's bordering on insolvency. I mean, that's sort of in the judgment, it's known as imminent insolvency, but it's a really gray area. And so, you know, in that context, if you are sitting there as a board of directors and you're concerned about steps being taken, my real sort of urge throughout this, and it's a common theme I think will be throughout this podcast, is to go and take independent advice, be it from insolvency practitioners or from lawyers. You know, making big decisions about where the company's stretched funds are going to go might come back to bite the company or the directors personally.
Yeah, at least you can then say, we you know, perhaps we weren't sure exactly where the boundaries were, so we took advice and we acted upon it. And unless it was apparent to us that the advice was not correct and couldn't possibly make sense, surely that's what more could we have been expected to do? And as you said, if that's a common law duty, that is going to, by its very nature, evolve over time. So the advice a year ago may not be the same as in 2 years' time. That's really, really helpful. Thanks. And what about if we move through the process steps? You've got the board, they look and go, we've taken advice, we've got to go into insolvency proceedings of one form or another here. What about the liabilities of the IPs, as we call them, or administrators on this? Do they get, have they got a freer pass or a freer hand to do what they need to do if they're trying to save a company or indeed maximize return for creditors?
Yeah, they don't have a free hand. It's sort of a very difficult question to answer, but because there's sort of many facets factored into any appointment of what was generally known as office holders. Office holders, I mean liquidators or administrators. Taking a step back, an office holder has an insolvency license for a start to take on their roles that they do. And they are highly trained and highly regulated, probably more regulated than lawyers, probably more regulated than any other industry, actually. So when they are appointed under that umbrella, they will not take steps that may result in them losing the license. And it's an obvious thing to say, but they accordingly are very aware of their duties in their role as administrator, in their role as liquidator. So moving on to what those duties are, very, very high level, it's really to maximize realizations for and on behalf of the creditors of the company. And in that context, whether administration, liquidation, they sometimes have to make really tough decisions as to where the business is going to go in very short timeframes. And sort of recent cases challenging office holders' decisions have seen the courts, and this is very general, but I think it's a fair comment to say, have seen the courts take a sort of largely commercial and purposive approach to those ends.
Has that developed out of the, you might not agree with the proposition, but generally speaking, uncertainty is greater, market uncertainty, geopolitical volatility, climate change, pandemics, perhaps that context has been built into the court's view on this, that it's a different time to what it was maybe 20 years ago in terms of, I know obviously it's depends on the sector, it depends on the work they're doing, but
I mean, I think
mid-pandemic, you might be given slightly greater degree of discretion over how well you did at predicting what was going to happen next.
Yeah,
I think Adam, sorry, I was just going to come in with, I think that, you know, the whole sort of breathing space aspect of the administrators, particularly on a matter like the employment contracts, is really important. So a lot of the time, administrators will be appointed. They don't know what is really in that company. They don't know whether they are going to take on the employees. Really important to note that the administrators don't become the employer. The administrator is very much the agent of the company. But for all intents and purposes, the employees will see them as the, as the body, as the individuals from which they are then taking their instructions. Yeah. And this whole sort of breathing space for administrators of 14 days before they have to decide whether to adopt the employment contract or effectively dismiss employees, you know, has been given to them because it's recognised that they've got a really difficult job. And I think, as Michael was saying, you know, that's why the courts have been more commercial and say, you know, and to the extent that tying their hands too tightly is probably not going to have the impact that the Insolvency Act purpose requires, which is to try and realise funds left for creditors.
And 14 days, you know, seems like a long time. But for, you know, administrators appointed over a PLC with 300 employees on a hostile appointment, so appointed by a lender, for example, it's not an awful lot of time to consider that position of those employees. And they'll have teams of people who do it, of course, and they'll do it well usually, but it's a sort of thankless task. And you know, if an employee is still there after 14 days, the law is clear that that contract is adopted as an expense of the administration. So it's a sort of that plays into how the administration play, you know, then goes through. So it's very difficult. And I mean, I would say in that context, you know, the courts and within the legislation, office holders are able to go to court for directions. But, you know, on the other side of the courts don't like making the decisions for office holders. And so if you play that back, if a office holder does make a decision without going to court, the courts are reluctant to unpick that decision unless there's something significant that hasn't been contemplated by that office holder.
Yeah, I get it, because the more that happens, the more office holders go, we better go to court, because I've seen time and again that this gets unpicked later and I don't want them marking my homework and rewriting it. And so the courts tend to, what you're saying, they're reluctant to get involved in that. And they trust the regulatory framework to a large degree.
Yeah, and they sort of, I have experienced the court pushing back on an application being made for directions because it's a commercial decision and courts aren't there to make commercial decisions.
Yeah.
So in that context, you know, if there's a legal decision to be made, then the court is the right place for that.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that they're immune or that it's impossible for IPs to get on the wrong end of this. And there's a case, Derbyshire magistrates, Rebecca, I think, that suggests you can get in some very hot water as an insolvency practitioner, depending on how you handle insolvency. And that must be a warning sound against this context of, generally speaking, it's a commercial thing.
Yes. I mean, RB Derbyshire magistrates was first heard back in, I think, May 2018. And the initial decision of the district judge at that point said that the insolvency practitioner, the administrator, who had taken a step of dismissing a substantial number of employees and had failed to file something called an HR1 form with the relevant government body, was actually personally liable on a criminal basis in respect of the failure to file that particular form. So there's been uncertainty for about 5 years as to whether an administrator, for the purposes of this particular piece of legislation requiring the filing of an HR1 form, whether the administrator was an officer of the company. Mm. Fortunately, the administrators generally, the Supreme Court found in November last year that they were not officers of the company, and therefore they could not have personal liability for the failure to notify the Secretary of State for proposed collective redundancies. Now, that's a long time to be under for this particular administrator, you know, a potential criminal sanction. Doesn't carry imprisonment, but, you know, it does carry, you know, the stigma of an offence and a fine, and probably did mean that administrators were perhaps a little more reticent in taking some bold decisions than they would have been. And I think going back to Michael's point about the commerciality of the court, this particular judgment, if you read the interpretation of what an officer of the company actually is, it feels like the judges were really torturing themselves to come to the decision that they wanted to, which was that the administrators should not be personally liable. I think it could have gone either way, but I think because of the commerciality aspect, they felt that they didn't really have much choice other than to say the administrators were not officers of the company and therefore could not be personally liable for the criminal sanction.
I think it's worthwhile. Sorry to interrupt. I think it's worthwhile sort of giving a bit of context for what an administration or a purpose of administration is. in the context of this case, because I think if this case, if the Supreme Court had found against the administrator, then I think that one of those purposes would have been, you know, largely not explored, or at least in very limited circumstances explored by office holders in the capacity of administrators. So administration, there are three purposes. The first, and it's sort of in this order, is to rescue the company as a going concern. Second is to achieve a better result for the company's creditors to hold than would be if the company was entered into liquidation. And the third is to realize some or all of the assets to make a distribution to preferential creditors. But going to the first one, rescuing the company as a going concern, it's in that context where administrator might be appointed, might be looking at, you know, at the business and making some very critical strategic decisions to dismiss employees to effectively make the business more viable for a rescue, i.e. purchase. And in that context, if administrators were going to be criminally personally liable for making redundancies in the first 14 days because they hadn't complied with TOLCRA, then you would have looked, and I think you would have, and I think I suspect the Supreme Court foresaw this, that this rescue, the purpose of administrations, the rescue culture for viable businesses that had got themselves into financial difficulties would likely not have followed.
What does that leave as liability then for not necessarily the administrator personally, but the company, the insolvent business, or the IP in a broader sense? If we say, look, you're not personally liable for this criminal act of not filing the HR1, but what are the repercussions then for the relevant parties? This is probably a question to both of you in terms of, we haven't complied with TOLCRA, we've dismissed everybody in 14 days, even though there was clearly over 20 employees and there were other things that we'd ordinarily be expected to do.
Well, I think very quickly, from an administrator's point of view, this case doesn't give administrators carte blanche to do what they like. Hmm. You know, one might argue there's a loophole there, allowing administrators to deliberately fail to file an HR1 form, but that I don't think is what this case does. I think this case just shows that the courts are there to take a commercial view of administrators making difficult decisions in short periods of time, which may fall foul of some other legislation, unfortunately. So I don't think it gives administrators carte blanche, as I said, to do what they like.
No, and there's also lots of liabilities that will fall upon the company, and which will potentially reduce the distribution to creditors if the administrators get some of the employment aspects wrong. So if there's an unfair dismissal or a wrongful dismissal where employees are not paid their notice pay, then although there is a potential safety net for employees in that they can make claims to the National Insolvency Fund, those claims really relate to minimum payments the employee could expect. So, for example, statutory minimum notice periods as opposed to contractual notice periods, the employees could go back to the employer, to the administrators, and say, well, look, I've received maybe 4 weeks notice from the National Insurance Fund, but the remainder of my notice period, the contractual element, I will consider that a debt. So that will go into the proof of debt, and there will be the requirement to pay out with any realizations. So if the administrators are effectively reducing the pot available to perhaps other creditors as well by reason of getting some of the legislation wrong with regards to employees, I can't see how that can be fulfilling their duties properly as an administrator. Yeah.
That draws the threads together nicely. This, as we touched on at the start, this very difficult balance and fine line that you're walking as an administrator, because as you say, that's maybe where the issue bites. That's what I was trying to get to there, that, well, we could do this without having any regard for that piece of legislation, but that's going to bite back on us potentially financially at this later juncture, which means we're not achieving the one of the objectives, which is to realise assets or value out of the business for creditors. So I've got to balance that against the benefits to the business of just terminating now. An unenviable position, we might say, if you're listening to this and you're not an insolvency practitioner, to have to strike that balance. But that's been really helpful to draw those things together and understand that dynamic, I think, for employees, but also directors who are involved in this and need to be thinking about the processes and what happens when you start to involve insolvency practitioners and what their considerations are. So we're coming up for time, but a question to both of you then to close out, and we're going to try and put in the biggest dollop of hope as you can, remember, from what we talked about earlier, to try and put a positive spin on the end of this, otherwise some might say slightly gloomy session. I won't put it any higher than that. Taking into account the complexities then that we've touched on in when you're looking at insolvency options and the impacts on employees, what are each of your key takeaways for companies who are in financial distress? Let's start with Rebecca.
I think it's to take the expert advice that's needed. Don't sit in that lonely place. If you do that, you're probably going to get things wrong. You're probably going to cut corners. Remember that there is a requirement, a legislative requirement, to get things right with regards to employee action. And also for employers to remember that, you know, they can't automatically pass the, you know, the payment liability back on to the government or even to the administrators. You know, there could be action taken against directors personally if they have, you know, got things wrong, they've continued to trade when they, you know, really shouldn't have done. So, yes, getting that expert help as early on as possible.
Now, I know that's one of your takeaways, Michael, already. So you've gone second, which is the more difficult position now as a result. But is there anything else you want to add on that, or a completely different take on this?
I think it really is get there early. That, you know, the longer one leaves it, company and the directors leave it, the less options you have, which may result in a sort of gloomy end. But there are some real positives that can be taken out of distress scenarios. If you take advice early, whether that's independent insolvency advice or legal advice, and using kind of the skills and tools available to the directors of managing those problems as effectively as possible, make businesses better and more adaptable and more sort of forward facing, and working with lenders, etc., and their creditors to overcome natural hurdles that businesses face.
Yeah, and I suppose even if the advice you're seeking is simply confirmation of whether it is time for you to be seeking advice. If nothing else, you know, tell me, should I be doing this now, or am I getting ahead of myself? All right. Well, thank you both very much. That's been really helpful. Not sure how positive we ended on the note, but I guess it's positive in the sense of support is out there and is available to people to call upon, and as we've said, the very clear message is don't sit and wait and suffer in silence. So thank you both very much for that illuminating session, and do follow us and the podcast either via our website or via LinkedIn. We'll be updating with more information about future sessions and further materials you can read on our subjects on our website as well, and follow us on wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for listening.